If you like having Bible study in your pocket and you have an iPhone or iPad, why not leave a review? Search Bible Study Evangelista in iTunes and tell everyone how you're loving and lifting all you've been given. Here's Sonia.
Let's get social. Connect with me at Bible Study Evangelista on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and now you can also find me on the number one Catholic app for iPhone and Android, Laudate. Let's connect. And now, let's get some Bible study in your pocket. Bible Study Evangelista Show. I'm Sonia Corbett, your Bible Study Evangelista. We're in our 7 I Am Statements of Jesus series. We have looked at why the number 7 is important and how the Gospel of John, John the Apostle, who wrote that Gospel, what he was trying to say by using these 7 statements of Jesus in his Gospel writings. So we know the significance of the number 7. We know the significance of I am, what both John and Jesus were saying when Jesus made these claims. So we know about the number 7. We know about I am. We have looked at I am the bread of life, and we've looked at I am the light of the world. And today we're going to look at I am the door, Jesus said in chapter 10 of the Gospel of John. I am the door. And in order to understand the significance of what Jesus says in this passage, we probably need to back up one chapter to chapter 9. And as I have mentioned several times before, when there's a whole lot of ground to cover through your reading, then it's important sometimes to just look at the paragraph or chapter headings. Now, at this point in the Gospel of John, the relationship between Jesus and the establishment religious people, the Pharisees, has become very strained. Now, if I back all the way up to chapter 8, that's where the adulterous woman was about to be stoned, and he used his finger and wrote in the dirt, which is an allusion to, or a reference back to, the Ten Commandments, which were said in the Old Testament to have been written by the finger of God. And so Jesus uses his finger and he writes something in the dirt. We don't really know what it is, but it's interesting to me that, you know, he made a show of using his finger. So it seems to be a reference to that, Ten Commandments. And then they get really upset at him, and they begin to have this conflict, and it becomes really serious because Jesus says to them, before Abraham was, I am, because basically they called him a bastard in chapter 8, 37 about 59. And when he said that, it says in verse 59, they took up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so he passed by. So somehow he hid himself and just walked out. So they have this really intense confrontation where they call him a bastard, you know, and because they claim to be Abraham's children. And Jesus says, you don't even know Abraham. If you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham, which that was faith. The work of Abraham was faith. And because the Pharisees don't have faith in Jesus, and really the whole reason why he's making these statements and he does these miracles is to engender in them this faith, and they just refuse. And so at that point, they tried to kill him then, but it wasn't his moment, and he knew that. So he hid himself and he walked right through the middle of them. And then the very next thing that John sets up is this miracle of a blind man being healed and receiving his sight. And it's so interesting that John has ordered everything this way, because we can really see the building of the conflict and how it's gonna you just get this sense that it's gonna crash and burn. I mean, I know we already know it, but the more you really dig into this, especially the way John writes, he's part of why I love him so much, is that he is so careful and so pointed. You know, he doesn't put things together for no reason. He has a really, he's a great teacher. So the man who was blind is healed by Christ. And so Jesus, he makes clay with spit and dirt. And he tells the blind man to go to the pool at Siloam, which if you went with me on the pilgrimage, then you saw. And that actually means sent, the pool, which is called Siloam, which means sent. And so Jesus sent him to the pool, and he came back after he washed his eyes. He came back seeing. Well, they start to question him. The Pharisees want to know what happened. How did he come back seeing? And he says that a man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And so he did. And they say, well, where is he? And he says, I don't know. So they brought him to the Pharisees. Now, that's probably because the people want to know if Jesus is the Messiah, if he's the Christ. And so they go to the Pharisees to present this miracle. And instead of believing, they get angry. They get more angry, and they start to question him. And then they excommunicate the healed man. And they ask him, who is this Jesus? And he says, first he answers that he is a man named Jesus. Then he answers that he's a prophet. And then the Jews didn't believe him. And in fact, they didn't even believe that there was an actual miracle. They called his parents and asked if this was their son and was he born blind? And they said, yes, but don't question us. Ask him, he's of age. And so they do. They called him again and they say, give God the glory. And what that really means, it's a solemn charge to declare the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So this is a really important exchange that's happening here. It's very serious, because if the Pharisees had told everybody not to be acknowledging Jesus at all, and upon pain of excommunication from the synagogue, which was important because you could not do business with any person who had been excommunicated. So his parents are, you know, they're likely very nervous, although the blind man, you know, there's who knows what he did for his job, you know. But in any case, they want to know what he says, what he will say about Jesus. And so they question him for a third time. And he says, why? This is a marvelous thing that you don't know where he's from. Yet he opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but anyone who is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it's been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And they answered him, you were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us? And they cast him out. Now, this is important because in fact, the whole exchange begins with the disciples. They bring, or they refer to the blind man, and they say, who sinned, Rabbi, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And the reason they ask is because the Jewish understanding was that anyone who had a disability or tragedy or suffered anything like that, remember from our series on Job that his friends kept blaming him because he was suffering. And so all suffering and all disability and all illness and all sickness was, according to the Jewish thought, because someone had sinned. So for this man to have been born blind, that's why the disciples say, who sinned here? Was that his parents or did he? And Jesus said, neither. He was born blind so that I could heal him, is basically what he tells them. And so that's what the Pharisees mean when they make that remark. You were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us? And they cast him out. So they did excommunicate him. Now here's where Jesus starts to talk about the door idea. It says that Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and when he found him, the man who had been blind, but was now healed, he said to him, do you believe in the Son of God? And he answered and said, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? And Jesus said to him, you have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you. And then he said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, for judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind. And then some of the Pharisees who were with him heard his words and said to him, are we blind also? And he said, if you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say we see, and therefore your sin remains. What he means is the sin of an unfaith, a lack of faith, and a refusal, actually, to believe, a complete refusal to believe. So then Jesus begins this teaching. Most assuredly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he brings out his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. Yet they will by no means follow a stranger, but will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of a stranger. And Jesus used this illustration, but they did not understand the things which he spoke to them, because they didn't want to. And then he said to them again, most assuredly I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. Now, I'm going to just stop here because I don't want to go too far, because right in the same passage is where he says, I am the good shepherd, and we'll talk about that next week. But it's important. Well, there's so many good things that I can't get into until we get over on the other side of the break. But we'll talk about shepherding and doors and all that when we get back. I'm Sonia Corbett, your Bible study evangelista.
You're listening to the Bible Study Evangelista Show, Bible Study Spirits That Taste Like Cake.
Sonia created the Love the Word Bible Study Method just for you, based on Mary's personal practice and formulated for your personality and temperament. Get your Love the Word meditations every Monday morning by signing up at BibleStudyEvangelista.com. Now, here's Sonia.
So really the question here then is, who has authority? Who is the door? Is it Moses? Is it the Old Testament? Or is it the Messiah? If the Messiah has come, it has to be the Messiah. And so when Jesus says, I am the door, there are, actually you can translate that in two ways. You can say a gate or a door, and they're obviously a lot like, you know, what we understand. They were usually made of wood, and oftentimes they were sheeted with metal on either side to prevent fire, and also to make them more strong in case of an attack, especially when it was an actual gate to a city. But sometimes in a home, then it had metal sheeting on either side. Sometimes it was, as I said, just a single slab of stone. We can see that in some of the archaeological excavations. And it had hinges, a lot like ours, that have had sockets at the top and the bottom. And then they either had a bolt. A lot of times, if it was a gate, it would have been bolted by a long beam. We see that kind of stuff all the time on movies, right? The way those were made. Sometimes in a home, they had a couple of leaves, sort of like folding doors. And we see that in connection with the temple in 1 Kings 6. And then, as I said, a lot of times door is used, and when I say used, I mean in the Bible. Sometimes the word door is translated there in connection with the city gates. And so that's where they swing on hinges, you know. So when the word door or gate is used in reference to a city, the gate was especially subject to attack, and because that was how you get in and out. And so to possess the gate then meant to possess the whole city, and the gate was protected by a tower. So even the farm laborers slept in the cities, and so because of that, all of the men would have passed through the gate every day, and that was why it was sort of a meeting place. We see that all over the scriptures, but specifically Ruth 4 and 2 Samuel 15, and like for an assembly, they would assemble there. And so It was called Broad or Open Places sometimes, and they were the center of public life. And so the markets were there, and sometimes the legal tribunal occurred there, so that a seat among the elders in the gates, as we see in Proverbs 31:23, was a really high honor. And then the opposite, oppression in the gates, was synonymous for judicial corruption, which in a sense Jesus is accusing the Pharisees of in this passage. So the king especially held public audiences at the gates, and they were the places where, because they were places where lots of people gathered, then the prophets and the teachers would all give their message there. So all that's the literal meaning, right? But figuratively, we've already seen that Jesus says he is the door. And what he means is that he is the door to gospel ministry. He is saying that ministers must receive their authority from him, and they must exercise it in his spirit. And that's partly what we learned through the light of the world last week, that Jesus is the center of the lampstands in the book of Revelation in chapter 1. And that's because he is the one who has the authority. And so it must be his way and by his selection. And so he says that through faith in him, shepherds and sheep enter into the kingdom of God. And that means those who minister to the sheep, which would be the hierarchy, and the sheep themselves. So it all flows then from the one head. We also see in Revelation chapter 3, this was in the readings a couple days ago, and it has special meaning for me, but in Revelation 3:20, he talks about, I stand at the door and I knock, and anyone who opens, I love that. I love that imagery of him patiently waiting outside the door, waiting on us to open the door to him so that he can come in and eat with us, it says. And so we see sometimes that it's used, the word door or gate is sometimes used to show an opportunity. For instance, an opportunity to preach the gospel somewhere, St. Paul talked about. But also, it can be figurative of freedom and power, as in Colossians chapter 4. But when we talk about gate, when we see gates spoken about in like grandiose terms, then it's talking about the glory of a city and also its protection, as in the gates of hell will not prevail. And when we hear that it could mean hell, although that Hades thing is probably not satanic, but more likely the gates of the grave, which are what keep the dead from returning, right? But either way, I have always found that interesting, that the gates of hell will not prevail. We always think of that as an offensive kind of thing, that the gates of hell are coming toward us, but gates don't go places. They protect a city or a home. And so the gates of hell then are defensive. We are the ones who are on the march, because Jesus is the door. He is the gate. All right, so what he's saying then to the Pharisees is that everyone who came before him has no authority whatsoever. And that's true, because the Messiah has arrived. And once he has arrived, then everything else is fulfilled and done with, and something new has come. And so he says to them, I am the door. Now, back then, our hierarchy is actually based on the Old Testament hierarchy, and they had the high priest, they had the priests who were under the high priest and led by him, and then the Levites who were helpers for the priests. And so that's, you can see our same three-tier hierarchy. We have the Pope, we have the bishops, we have the priests, the priesthood, and also the deacons. So the high priest then changed every year, who is also a brother bishop, and then the priests, and then the deacons who help the priests. So all of that hierarchy is that we have is based on what went before in the Old Testament. And so Jesus is saying that's done with now. I am the door. If you're going to get in to heaven, that's essentially what he's saying. Because he says later that I came that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly, he says. Anyone who enters by me will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. And so I find it actually striking that he's using this imagery. He's talking about shepherding and doors. And why is that? Because in those days, in fact, we saw this too. We went to the shepherd's field and we saw where the shepherds were tending their flocks when the star appeared and the angels sang. Anyway, so they would have stayed out in the hill country with their flocks all the time. And then lots of people and lots of shepherds would have brought their flocks in together and put them in sort of like a pen, but not like we're used to seeing. It would have been either a kind of short rock wall. Sometimes, though, they could be made of like sticks and thorns to keep the sheep in, but also to keep predators out. That was the point. And all of the shepherds then would put all of their sheep in together overnight so that they would stay safe. And then in the morning, the shepherd would go to the door and ask the doorkeeper to let him in. And he would call out his own sheep and he would call them by name. And this is a sweet picture too, because he knows every name of every sheep. And they did that as a sort of an affectionate kind of thing. Now, shepherding was not it wasn't a job that people wanted. It had no importance to it at all. And in fact, it looked down upon just because it was a very menial kind of job. And a lot of times shepherds were not good people. And that's partly why that's about the only work they could get. Sometimes also shepherds would collect their animals and keep them in a cave. So there would have been a doorkeeper or a porter, sometimes it was called. But he would guard the sheep overnight. So when Jesus says, "I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold, I'm sorry, by the door, but climbs up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber." And so a thief steals in secret, a robber plunders openly, but he is saying that the Pharisees have secured their power illegitimately. That's what he's saying, that they're thieves and robbers. Whereas in contrast to the thief or the robber, the true shepherd comes through the door. And in fact, not only does he go through the door, he is the door. And so he's sort of putting all of these metaphors together, but they would have known exactly what he meant. So the doorkeeper then was sort of like an under shepherd. And so we see also that as I mentioned, that personal address from the shepherd is a daily thing. He calls the sheep by name every day to bring the sheep out and to take them to pasture. Then he says, "But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out." That word leads is, or brings out, is the same word used in chapter 9 of the Pharisees when they cast out the blind man. They excommunicated him. So they cast him out, and so Jesus leads his out, because the sheep, the true sheep, because he knows, they know his voice. They know that he's the true shepherd. A stranger, obviously, would be anybody that the sheep don't know, or it doesn't necessarily mean a thief or a robber, but it could be. But they won't follow him even if he uses the shepherd's call and he knows their names. They know the true shepherd. More on that when we get back.
You're listening to the Bible Study Evangelista Show. Bible Study spares that taste like cake.
Did you know you can get Bible Study Evangelista radio notes and podcasts delivered to your inbox every Monday morning? Redeem your Mondays. Join thousands of your fellow listeners by subscribing at BibleStudyEvangelista.com. Now, here's Sonia. If you love having Bible Study in your pocket, you can become a friend of the show. Click on the yellow Friend of the Show button on BibleStudyEvangelista.com and become a supporter of any amount and any frequency. Now, here's Sonia.
So So we've heard Jesus calling out the Pharisees again. We've seen this conflict boiling over, and we've heard Jesus say, "I am the door." And part of why he would say that, it's, and as well as being the shepherd, he would say he was the door because sometimes a shepherd would lay down across the entry of the sheepfold at night to sleep there so that predators couldn't get in and wild beasts, and then the sheep wouldn't leave. Because also a predator would scare the sheep, and that's why he could both be the shepherd and the door at the same time, if that was confusing you. So he is confronting the thieves and the robbers, who are the Pharisees, and he's telling them, and this is what's so sweet about this exchange, because Jesus is actually speaking. He's speaking to the blind man that he healed, and he's basically telling him, don't you worry about them excommunicating you, because I'm the door, not them. And he has led him to faith in himself, in Christ. And in so doing, he has really led him to not just a new life of sight, but well, yes, a new life of sight, but both spiritual and physical. And so now he has a spiritual sight that the Pharisees lack. And that's what's so good about how John has positioned this story, because he's showing that here they were so critical of this blind man because he was, quote, in sin. And the blind man is just, he's just shocked that he can even see. He's stunned by the miracle. He embraces it. He wants to know who Jesus is. He accepts Jesus, and he puts his faith in him. And that's what those signs are meant to do. They were meant to bring people to faith in him. And a lot of people did have faith in him. But imagine that you have seen this miracle. Imagine, now I don't know how private this was. I don't know if it was him and Jesus standing face to face and there weren't any other people around. I don't know, but even if it weren't that way, or if it was, I mean, even if it was a very private moment and nobody saw it, can you imagine being his parents and or being the man himself, and suddenly you see, and you have not been able to see your whole life? And so Jesus is showing the Pharisees, this man sees. He was blind, but he sees. You have sight and you can't see a thing because you are willfully, stubbornly blind. So he goes to seek out the blind man to assure him, almost to take up for him, really. You know, you may have been excommunicated, but trust me, you got more than you ever bargained for in accepting me and receiving me and allowing me to heal you. And I asked the Lord not long ago, I said, Lord, why are you so good to me? And he said, because I love you. And I was like, well, that's just not going to work, Lord, because you love everybody. and it stopped me in my tracks, because he said, you let me. And I thought, oh my gosh, this man, this blind man, allowed Jesus to heal him. And because of that, he got eternal life too. And that is part of what Jesus is trying to show the Pharisees. And he is becoming increasingly strong with them because they are increasingly obstinate. And not only that, but they are searching for ways to kill him. They've already tried to stone him. And it just, we know, it builds and builds and builds until they finally do. They go to illegal lengths to crucify Jesus. There was so many of the things that happened that night, well, all the way up until this point, or the point of the crucifixion. There were so many things that they did that were, you know, here they're nitpicking the law. And part of the reason that they were upset at Jesus for healing the blind man is because it was on Sabbath, and he worked on the Sabbath by mixing the dirt and the spit. And so because of that, they say that he could not come from God. He's a sinner. And so they're nitpicking that part of the law, which isn't even part of the law. It does say don't work, but who says that dirt and spit mixture is work, right? And if anybody has a say in that, it should be Christ. Of course, you know, they didn't listen to anything he said, which is the issue here. But because they were so obstinate, and because they hated him so much, they nitpicked the silly parts of the law, and yet the really important ones of justice, they completely threw to the winds as soon as this hatred took root in their hearts against Jesus. That is a scary position to be in, friend. When we keep on and on and on, and we will not listen to God when He's speaking to us about possibly it's a sin habit or a relationship or something we need to begin doing, or it could be anything. And I guarantee that as I said that, He probably brought something to your mind. And so the warning here is, don't be willfully blind. Allow Jesus to heal you because He wants to. Jesus says that His sheep hear His voice. They hear His voice and they know Him. And in that, anytime you see that word know in the scriptures like that, it's that biblical language is not like an intellectual knowledge. It's the fruit of an experience or personal contact, an experience of God, an experience of Christ. And once it matures, it becomes love. And that is what Jesus is trying to do. He spends the days and the nights with the sheep. He is the door. He's the door through which we receive heaven. And in fact, we could even say that the cross is that door. He says that broad is the way that leads to hell and narrow is the way that leads to life. And that's part of why, because He is willing to suffer. It's interesting that Thomas A. Kempis actually says that the more you know and the better you understand, the more strictly you will be judged, unless your life is also the more holy. And so that's part of why Jesus was so upset at the Pharisees, because they weren't holy. They weren't. They were robbers and thieves for the most part. Now, there were a few. Nicodemus is one of them. And there were followers, but they would have been excommunicated if those in charge had found out. So Nicodemus had to go to Jesus at night. It's just so tender that, you know, we know this story. We've heard these words, I am the door, I am the shepherd, we'll see next week. And it's just the sweetest, tenderest thing, I think, to realize that these words were spoken in order to encourage this one poor soul whose connection to Jesus and receiving that healing had landed him in this really terrible situation. It's a very sweet, tender thought that we should really meditate on. And Jesus has challenged the decision-making and the action of this excommunication of this person. And He basically says, you're not even a real shepherd. How could you have any authority whatsoever? I read or heard a story once about a guy who was in World War I, or one of the world wars, and they had been fighting for so very, very long, and they had just gotten to where they could rest a little bit, and in like a town, and so they had been able to rest, and they got to see, you know, beautiful things again, instead of the ravages of war, and the blood, and the guts, and the how awful all of that was. They were able to be sort of in a town with the houses and he was actually in, I think he said in France, but you know, from pictures, how beautiful that would have been. The homes and the flowers and the little gardens and all that stuff, you know, and good people who were kind. But then as soon as they got there and were supposed to have this rest, word came that the line was broken and that the Germans were just streaming in and that they were headed for the channel. And then the soldiers who were supposed to have this 5 days of rest, they ended up having to go back. And the man said that he was so angry. He was just really resentful and angry that, first of all, they weren't going to be able to rest, but secondly, that all of his buddies, you know, that they were going to be thrown right back in and their lives put in danger again. And he said that they were all waiting, and he took a little stroll in the village, and he said he turned this little corner, and it was this huge field of flowers. He said they were beautiful, like, you know, gold, like yellow and blue. And he said that he was so shocked because It was such a beautiful sight after all that they had seen. But he said that he saw a shepherd boy, and he noticed that he wasn't driving the flock or whacking them, you know, with the staff or the stick. He didn't have a dog. He was just walking ahead of them, and they were following him willingly. And he said he thought about that, and he thought of how when Jesus brings out the sheep, he goes before them, and he thought about the fact that Jesus went before him in the valley of death. And he said that it helped him be able to just get enough breath that he could get back into the fray and go back to fighting. I thought that was one of the most beautiful stories. So your shepherd goes before you through your suffering and even to death. We'll be back in a moment.
Thank you for listening to the Bible Study Evangelista Show. Find out more at BibleStudyEvangelista.com.